Blog Talk Radio. Good evening and welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon, the podcast that loves you, the podcast with more celebrities than the inauguration, and that is the truth. I'm your hostess, your groove mistress and cruise director, Madame Perry, but you can call me Jan, Jennifer, musicians always call me JP. It doesn't matter. I'm just happy that you're here. And also I'm happy for the nice reviews you leave for the podcast on Stitcher, Apple iTunes, and say that you like the guest, you enjoy, you love the guest, that you don't care if it's somebody you already know, like maybe Lita Ford is coming on or someone, or if it's somebody you've never heard, an anthrozoologist, you like them all the same. And another thing I really enjoy about this audience, about all of you, is that you let me know when I've got a guest coming on, you go out and do your homework, you do the research and find out. Like I put out something about tonight's guest last week, and all of a sudden you're sending me, yes, I've checked this, I'm watching this, I'm researching that. That is a wonderful thing, and it's fun, as you all telling me. So, by the way, again, it's because you subscribe and you share this podcast and listen, you allow me to keep having the fantastic guests we've been having, like Billy Vera was on, last month, Donnie Most. Coming back very soon is Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Ricky Bird. You know him from playing guitar for Joan Jett, and he's got another CD fresh out. And so Ricky Bird will be coming back, and I think in about a week from now. That'll be fun, as always. And Joe Vitale, drummer for Joe Walsh and lots of other folks, he's going to be coming back very soon. So it just gets more and more fun. Now, tonight, I have been getting a lot of information, a lot of messages about this. We've all been checking this out. Everybody is totally excited. Honey, it's just like we've just amped up the room with more pheromones than anyone can hold. This man has been acting, performing since he was a child. He's got quite a story. Some people, you know, that you would like to parody the old ad where the guy said, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. This man can play things on TV and actually do them. And he's got a smoking hot documentary out that was filmed in 2012 by Josh Elvis Weinstein, but now it's out on Amazon Prime. We're all watching it. And I just want to introduce, because everyone is just, honey, we're just fanning ourselves down here in the South and everywhere else, to welcome to the genie bottle that is Madame Perry Salon, Marquis Michael DeBar. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon, Michael.
Good evening, darling. How are you?
I am doing so well. So
I'm so intrigued by the fact you call yourself Madame. You know, I mean, that word is so evocative of so many things. You explained to me that it was about your salon and that you were sort of, you know, sitting around with great poets and literature. But to me, it's a brothel. I mean, the word
a brothel
just makes me think of
a brothel.
Yes.
Well, I wasn't
yes.
fishing for compliments, but thank you.
Okay. I have turn hotel rooms into brothels, but I've never been to one.
Are you sure you didn't just dream that, maybe? You just thought you did? Are you pretty sure?
Oh, darling, I don't dream. I had took a nap in August of 1972. Are you kidding? I can't sleep. I'm an insomniac.
Well, why do you fill up all that time? Or are we going to talk about that for the next 30 to 45 or more minutes, maybe?
Well, I don't know.
Where
I'll
do we
start?
What would I have to do to get a? Yeah. We have to have a series, a Michael DeBar series. Okay, then. And then.
A Michael DeBar series. I've been in several series. You know, I mean, I've been a lucky guy. I've been a really lucky guy. And I just want to take this opportunity to thank anybody out there who has seen the documentary, because it's really incredible. You know, my life and the fact that the content that people need now, because they can't leave their homes, you know, which is so awful what we're going through right now, to be able to entertain on the radio, you know, every day I'm on Sirius XM. And it's a wonderful opportunity to communicate with people, because now is the time when we must, you know, get together and literally embrace each other, even from 6 feet away. You know, you need very long arms and a big heart to embrace each other. But it's the only way that we can deal with the madness that we're surrounded by.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. It's going to take every bit of imagination and entertainment. Although, you know, I was telling my husband the other day, I said, you know, because he was always says to me, he says, you really do entertain yourself, don't you? And I said, yeah, whenever I hear somebody say things are boring, I think, well, no, maybe that person is, because I've always been able to amuse myself one way or the other.
Well, I think about people being boring. If you find people boring, you're boring. You know, I mean, everybody has some story. And I think then the task becomes, how can I get underneath the nonsense and get to the person, you know, and really speak to the soul of the person. And over the years, I've discovered that, obviously, it's taken some time. But if you're bored, you're boring. Put it that way.
When I'm going to talk to you so much about, I don't know if you want to start with your music, or you've got the Who Do You Want Me to Be, the film. And let me tell you, you know, you say that song made you so much money. When you met Holly Knight and you wrote some songs together, and I believe you wrote that together, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have
Lovers,
any
idea? Writer, you know. Do I have any idea about what?
That song was going to explode.
No. You never know. You know, I mean, I've written so many, you know, for so many artists and myself, but you never know. In fact, it's something you can't predict. And if you do, you're probably wrong, you know. And the best songs, let's say the most successful songs, are the ones that you love. Those are the ones that people usually connect with, because, you know, they're the truth. You sing the truth. But some songs go by the wayside, and some that you never thought would be a hit are a hit. You know, it's the strangest thing. I wrote the lyric of that song, and Holly wrote the music, and I wrote the melody and the words. But at the time, we had no idea that it would, you know, be number one everywhere, you know, in the whole, in the, you know, 27 countries.
And it was a theme song. It was a theme song
what?
For a fashion show on VH1. There was a fashion show that was their theme.
Yeah, that's right. It was. But, I mean, it's been in many movies, many TV series. That's why it's, you know, continued to, shall we say, be rewarding, you know, because it's been in so many and sung by so many. Some tremendous versions of it, but we didn't know that. I mean, I wrote that lyric in 10 minutes.
No.
Yeah, I wrote it in 10 minutes. It just went pow, you know, just screamed at me, get me on paper. and I did, you know, and then Holly is absolutely brilliant. Yeah, and then we did that chorus. Once we had the chorus, Who Do You Want Me to Be to Make You Sleep With Me? That's such a provocative sentence that it really just tells a story of passion, and people love to be passionate. You know, they might hide it, but that's what everybody wants, to be passionate about something and care about something, yeah, fall in love under whatever conditions. And that's what that song is. It's an obsession to be loved.
And when you say it like that, it makes it feel like that's the spark of life.
Yeah, well, what else is there except each other, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've loved all my wives.
Did you, did I say spark of wife or spark of life? Or I loved all your lives. Okay.
Yeah, my wives have been sparkling. Yeah.
Well, they have, yes. Hey, listen, my two husbands consider themselves husbands-in-law, so I figure...
That's great. I love to hear that. I love to hear that because, you know, you love them. Why on earth would you, you know, it just, you grow. I mean, you know, one changes throughout one's life. You know, as a young and I was 19 when I was first married, you know, I'm 156 now, you know, it's like things change for God's sake.
That's fine.
I'm Lestat, but I will never marry. This is it. I mean, I'm so in love with my wife and it's a beautiful thing.
Hey, by the way, oh, and hello to the lovely Britta. I don't know if she's with you there right now. And I remember, I think I've got to say I first learned about you or was first really aware of you when I read Pamela's books when it first came out, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I thought, yeah, I love Pamela.
Then I realized that there was a whole story behind this man. Go ahead.
Yes, there's a whole story. It's a thousand stories. I mean, when you've lived it like I have, you know, you start working when I was 8 years old and, you know, and I've been working for six decades and many things have happened. And it's been amazing. Each one after the other, boom, boom, boom. You know, there's been no, like, the only, you know, really dark cloud over my head that stopped me from shining and being, you know, and working and enjoying work was drugs, narcotics. You know, I was a junkie for 7 years of my life. And while I still kept working, I didn't enjoy it. And that would be the key. When I woke up one morning after, you know, being in a trance for a month or two, I realized, oh, no, this is just absolutely ridiculous. And that was 39 years ago. When I quit drinking and taking drugs. And I think it's very important to talk about it, or at least to let your audience and everybody else know that drugs suck, you know, and completely are the opposite of what you think. You know, thinking, oh, it's going to make me so creative and I'm going to be this different, unique and wonderful person. Nonsense. It doesn't do that. It actually strips you of any true passion. And great art comes from passion. Not, you know, this sort of nodding out and not being able to remember, you know, what where you are and all of this crap. You know, I hated it, and I got rid of it. And that was the downtime. And you know, Miss Pamela was so amazing during that course of time, but you know, she was saintly having to deal with me. But it was sort of de rigueur for rock and roll. I'm sure Ricky will tell you all about that. You know, Ricky Bird is a dear friend of mine. I love him. And
isn't he
you know,
wonderful?
Just a sober guy. Yeah,
he was
it.
On here about 2 years ago, and he's coming back with his new CD, and I just can't wait. So
yeah,
I'm glad to
go.
Know your friend.
He's a great
yeah,
guy.
I like for all the fun people to be pals.
Well he's got to check it out, and he takes it very seriously, though. You know, he's a keeper of the faith of rock and roll. He believes in rock and roll. And rock and roll, you know, is virtually extinct. If it wasn't for Little Steven's Underground Garage, my radio program, it probably would be.
That is a great, Little Steven's Underground Garage is fantastic. I love listening to you on there. It's just it's something where you can go to where you know you're going to hear something that you like, that you want to hear. And you and the other DJs are so much fun on there. But I also want to say right now, this is a good time to mention that if you're listening live tonight, and this is the 7th of September, 2020, and it is 8:13 p.m., that's if you're looking at my clock with its GMT minus 5, and you've got something, a question or comment for Michael DeBar, if you've seen his documentary, give us a call. The number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922. Toll-free call in the continental U.S. And if you're the people, and sometimes there are folks that follow the show that can't always get to a phone, maybe they're at a job where they got to be quiet or off the phone, you know, you can always send a message to me with a question or comment through Facebook, either through Jennifer Modette Perry or Madam Perry Salon. And Michael, if you would just, since one of the first guests I ever had on the show went back and told everyone, they said, I've been to Madame Perry's salon. It's like the inside of Jeannie's bottle. And then the word was out. So we've got somebody that's going to come into the Jeannie bottle, and I hope you're comfortable here right now. And so if you will just make a little room, welcome to Madame Perry's salon. Come on in, introduce yourself, and say hello to the Marquis Michael DeBar.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Good, good.
What are you wearing?
Oh, wait, this is still me. Hey, somebody in Atlanta, somebody with the 404 area code, come on in and say hello to Michael.
Hi.
Jennifer, do you have... Jennifer?
Yes?
No.
Can you hear me? I can hear you. It's a lady, Michael.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you both. Jennifer, it's Karen Head.
Hi,
Karen
how are
Head.
You? What's your name?
Karen Head, the poet, PhD. I told you she has a husband, English husband.
What? Oh, yeah, that's right, Karen. Oh, you saw the documentary, right?
I did. I did. We watched the documentary just the other night. It was a blast from my husband's past and actually made me think a little bit. You were talking, you know, so much in the documentary about, you know, the performative elements of your life and creating sort of the self that was necessary in the moment. And I was sort of struck because I started thinking, I was reading a few years ago at the Poetry Cafe in London, and there was a gentleman there. And he actually got up and walked out of my reading. And then the next night I was giving another reading at the Waterstones near Islington, and he was there again. And this time he stayed, and afterwards we were sort of having drinks, and he said, you know, he said, I just really didn't like who you were last night. I mean, you know, it's like you were, you know, all your, you know, the poems, I felt like you were talking about shopping, and it felt so commercial. But then tonight you seemed like you were real. It turned out that it happened to be David Allen from Soft Machine and Gong. And my husband wound up having sort of this long conversation with him. And so there was this music connection, and I had been reading the music, a lot of music poems the second night. And I guess that comes around to the notion of, I've been listening a lot on, you know, and reading a lot on the media about women performers, and especially women who've reinvented themselves several times, like Madonna, for instance, really coming under a lot of criticism. And I'm wondering if you feel that you had that's gendered in any way. Do you think that women take a lot more flack for inventing and reinventing themselves, or do you think that's not really a thing, or were you just you were lucky because you were able to constantly reinvent yourself just because of your own personality?
I don't think the sex has got anything to do with whether you can reinvent yourself. Every artist reinvents themselves because they get older. So when you're 18, you're revolutionary and you're full of fire and passion, and then you're 25 and you got married and you have a small child and you play different roles, and now you're 40 and you're playing the best friend of the star, and then you're 60 and it's over. So it's the same applies
well,
to
let's hope not.
I mean, there's no well, I don't believe in the word hope. I believe in the word faith. I don't believe hope at all. I'm telling you what it's like in show business. I'm explaining facts to you. In terms of recreating yourself, men go through the same situation. I mean, I don't think one sex is more difficult for one sex than it is for the other.
Well, I do think, I mean, I understand what you're saying about the process, and I agree. I guess my question was more, do you think that women come under more criticism for continuing to do that? So, for instance, like Madonna recently, that there's been a lot of, she needs to act her age, essentially, is what she's being told.
No, I don't pay any attention to that crap. That doesn't, it's not part of my world, you know. I mean, Madonna's great. She had a great career. She's worth $1 billion. What's the problem?
And okay, fair enough. There was also a little bit of mention of you writing poetry yourself. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that's not something that was really talked about all that much on the documentary.
Everything I say is a poem.
Oh.
If you think of
art, speak in poetry.
I believe everything I say is a poem. Yes, you heard me right. Because art is life, is my life. So therefore, I could go to the supermarket And within minutes, have people around me asking questions. Where'd you get those boots? Why did you kill Richard Dean Anderson? You know, whatever the question is, it's a show. So what is a show? Is it scripted? Is it unscripted? It doesn't matter. If you look at art, I look at my life as being the embodiment of art. So anything I say, it doesn't have to rhyme, as you know. But I wouldn't say I'm a poet. I would simply say I love to express myself in whatever form. It can be as a writer. You know, I have books of poetry out. I have albums out. I have movies out. I just express myself. You know, people say, well, what do you like best? And I say, everything. All of it. I'm not going to say this is better. This woman is, you know, women have more problems than men. Men have more problems. These are pedantic questions. Poetry is living. How's that?
I certainly agree with that.
All right.
Would you describe yourself as a poet or a housewife, or how would you describe yourself?
I normally, my go-to is that I'm a teacher and I'm a writer.
Do you think Marlon Brando was a teacher? Do you think Madonna's a teacher?
I don't know how they self-identify. I do think that they teach. I think they instruct through, you know, their art, because I think art is instructional in lots of ways.
Do you write poetry to instruct people?
Sometimes I think there is some life lesson that I'm hoping that someone will gain from reading poetry. My poetry.
So that means that means you've got the answer. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's instructional in a much broader sense. I mean, in the sense of how do we explore various conditions or challenges, and how do we think about ourselves? I think it's more of a conversation starter towards a better understanding kind of instruction than it's certainly not a lecture.
Why do you think the man left?
Why do I think?
The man left.
When David walked out of the reading. Well, I was reading some poetry that honestly he was entitled to his interpretation. He heard a handful of poems, and several of them made reference to things like being in Paris and visiting a shop in Paris and taking as
he
cues.
He left the building because you were in a shop in Paris?
No. He didn't like the poetry because, as he said, he took it to be about things that were unimportant. So his idea of poetry was much loftier than.
Wow! How presumptuous! How extraordinary! I would have chased him. I would have chased him down the street.
Well, I didn't know why he was
leaving
that night.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe he was high.
I think he was. I think he was fine. I think he just. You know, again, you said, do I think of myself as a poet? Here's where I struggle against that term. I think that everybody wants to be a poet. Being a poet, that sounds sexy. The actual work of writing poetry is actually not nearly as glamorous. It's like the music business. Everybody sees the show.
More. I couldn't disagree more. I couldn't disagree more. I think the poetry of children who have no educative knowledge at all write the most poignant and beautiful poems. In fact, what I did in my radio program is I end my radio programs at Little Stephen's Underground Garage with poems from around the world, from 9-year-old to 11-year-old children who are victims of the pandemic of COVID-19. And they are by far more engaging and interesting and beautiful and painful than any poet I've ever read.
Oh, no. You're misunderstanding what I'm saying, because I think anyone almost at any age that can communicate. I mean, I started writing poetry when I was 6 years old.
Right.
No, what I'm saying is that there are a lot of people who just want to pronounce themselves as the thing.
Who cares?
You know, I am.
Who cares,
you know, I am
about
a poet.
Other people?
Well, no. You said why don't
do we
I?
Care?
You know, you were asking me about my self-identity and sort of like, how do I personally, you know, do I say I'm a poet? And I tend to recoil a little against saying that I am a poet, simply because I feel like that carries
But you do consider yourself a poet. Why would you avoid describing yourself as such? Because you think other people will think that you're being overly dramatic?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes,
well, listen,
I think
can I give you a tip?
That.
Don't
sure.
worry about what other people say about you. If I'd worried about what people say about me, I would have, you know, hung myself on a bridge, you know, 40 years ago. When you do what I do, which is put yourself out there, now you're reading, you know, poetry, and that's giving something. It's such a generous thing to do. Now, people can come and criticize. If you listen to anybody that's critical of you, I think, and pay attention, it's a useless endeavor. So who cares what people say about the word poet?
Yeah.
Good. I've been called a lot worse.
Oh, well, have I.
By the way, Karen, I got to say, you know, because I've loved your poetry since I met you and learned about you from another Colin Kelly. But where was I going? I don't know. I was just going to say thank you so much for taking your time to call, for watching the documentary last week after I posted this. And we're going to have to...
Well, everybody needs to watch the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's called Who Do You Want Me to Be?
And continued good fortune with your poetry, which is just telling the truth, you know. It's interesting, your process. Do you write and then rewrite much, or do you just spit it out?
You know, occasionally you'll get that gift from the muse where it comes out and it mostly is unrevised. But no, there is some work that goes into most of it. You do have to revise and work through to get it to where it's where you kind of... I mean, I don't think it's ever, you know, it's the old cliche, writing is never actually finished, it's only due.
Well, good luck with your poetry. Are you published?
Yes, I have. I have about, my eighth book is getting ready to come out.
Fantastic. Well, the best of luck with it.
Yes. Okay. Well, and I highly recommend the documentary to everyone. So everybody should watch it. It's fantastic.
All right. Thanks, Karen. Thank you. Thanks to you and your hubby, Colin.
Sure. Thanks, Jen. Bye.
Hey, you come back here soon, okay, Karen?
Colin and I have that new book coming out together, so you'll have to have us on about that.
Definitely. Yes. Definitely. We'll set it up tomorrow. All right. Thanks very much.
Bye.
All right. And who else? Hi, welcome to Madame Perry Salon. You're on with the Marquis, Michael DeBar. So just introduce yourself. Say hello.
Dzień dobry. It's your favorite Polish cartoonist, Peter G.
Oh, hi.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
All right. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good.
That's good to hear. I was calling mostly because I was listening to your comments about you. Congratulations on being clean, by the way, because I've seen a lot of people just wreck themselves doing that. So, you know, fantastic job on that. I know it's not easy to beat.
What are you talking about?
So,
drugs?
Drugs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah. It's stupid. Kid stuff.
It's because I was thinking about the things you were saying about how it interferes with the creative process. I'm a huge fan of Trey Parker and Matt Stone from South Park. And
who?
Parker in an interview, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the creators of South Park.
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
And they were doing an interview, and they brought up how people think that with all the stuff they come up with, they must be on drugs or something when they write it. And Parker said, these people have never done drugs because they know that if you did drugs, you don't get a whole lot done. And we'd just be sitting around going, dude, you know, it'd be sweet. And we'd just kind of stop there for the entire day. You know,
the real thing about that is it. Yes, you do get a lot done, but it sucks.
Yeah, I really do wonder about the industry sometimes. I remember a story that Tom
What
Petty
industry?
Told,
Which industry are you talking about?
Well, the entertainment industry in general, because, like, you know, Robert
Downey. What a horrible discussion. Please proceed about about show business. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I remember a story about Tom Petty. Supposedly, Tom Petty, when he first got his record contract, he came into the studio and there were all kinds of drugs available. And he said, what's this for? They said, well, you're going to need to write. He says, no, I don't. They said, no, after your first album, you're going to be burnt out and you're going to need inspiration. But he never touched the stuff. And, you know, Robert Downey Jr., he kicked it and he's stayed clean ever since. And it's just amazing. You know, it's great to see people can actually, you know, lose the shackles.
Tom Petty was a drug addict.
He was? I didn't know that.
Do the research, my dear fellow. Yeah, I mean, he had tremendous difficulties with drugs. You know, when he broke his hip, unfortunately, he lost control of himself. It's a well-known fact.
Oh,
And in terms
nice
of Downey is a shining example of reincarnation. But we all are. You know, I mean, but to say that Tom Petty walked into a studio and turned down a joint is like saying there were five Beatles.
Well, I figured that part. I mean, with songs like Last Dance with Mary Jane, stuff like that, I'm like, yeah, I know, but I didn't think you did anything
Mary Jane,
harder
what does
that
stand for? Shampoo? I mean, come on.
Hey, we were all ignorant of the meaning at one time or another. We all had to learn.
Well,
all
yeah,
right.
We did, you know, and most people did, and the ones that didn't die.
Yeah, it's rough. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just anybody that
it's
could
beautiful.
Stay out of it.
Listen, it's life, man. You know, I'm glad I went through that experience because I learned a lot. I learned a lot about humanity, and I learned how painful addiction is because it's not a choice. You know, it's you are owned by it, and therefore I would, you know, created Rad, Rock Against Drugs for the MTV in the 80s. I don't know if you recall, but it was a series of ads of Ozzy Osbourne, John Bon Jovi, Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols. A lot of people, you know, for 30 seconds talked about drugs, you know, ruining their lives and how they got clean. I remember we went to Washington, me and my manager at the time, Danny Goldberg, and Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols, and asked for money to do a PSA campaign. And they gave us money, as did Coca-Cola. And we made all these ads. And it was called RAD, Rock Against Drugs. And it was tremendous. And that would never have happened if I hadn't done drugs. It's a weird world, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, so yeah, after getting sober, created an atmosphere within which I could have these PSAs out there with youngins on MTV when MTV was, you know, the electric church and everybody watched it and worshipped at it, as you know. You know, then every now and then, you know, somebody would pop up and go, you know, these suck, don't do them. Whether it made a difference or not, I think it did. But it's something that you have to explore and find out for yourself.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Peter, thank you so much for calling. Have you watched the documentary yet? Who Do You Want Me to Be?
I haven't had a chance to yet. It's on my list. I just haven't gotten to it yet.
Oh, good. Legit, man. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you'll. It's fascinating. I've watched it. I'm on my third time watching it. So because you're going to see it, and then you're going to. You're going to have to go back over and over to get everything, but it's fantastic. It's worth it. All right.
There's
thank
a
you
lot
so
of great
much,
people
sweetie.
In there. But thank you so much, Peter. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
Okay. Yeah, we've got another call here waiting for you. But you know what? You're right. With in the film, Who Do You Want Me to Be? You know, you start talking about, you know, your childhood, your parents. Actually, it starts back before that, back of what, in 1241 or something? But about your parents, your childhood, going to school, switching back and forth between personas. Like you've got to have that little posh sound in the boys' school and then have the street sound when you're in drama school. And people, and that was legit. I mean, when I grew up in the city of Atlanta, but I remember working at going to a school. Actually, it was a cosmetology school out in more of a rural area. And when I'd go to work in the daytime in a salon in a posh area of Atlanta, they would go, "Oh, you live in that city." You know, they thought I was just a country girl. Then I'd go out there an hour later for school. And they'd say, "Oh, you're from Atlanta. We don't like city gals." And wait.
Well, that's
like
it exactly. That's it exactly, Jennifer. That's exactly what I went through. But I, like you, was a chameleon, you know, and would fit into whatever situation I found myself in because I had no parental control. You know, I had no idea who or what I was. So I adapted to whatever community I happened to be in, and you clearly did also.
Did you think that was a big part of what made you such a success as an actor? That you could just
maybe. I mean, you know, people ask me that. You know, did that make you be able to slip and slide in terms of characters? But you know what? At the end of the day, if you look at all the things I've done, which is 150 hours of American television, 40 movies, and 20 albums, everything I've done, it's been the same guy. I mean, whether it be funny rock and roll star or whether I be an assassin, I'm still me. Yeah, I don't profess to change into. Yeah, I'm not a method actor. You know, I just say the words and you know, try and wear like a good outfit.
Yeah, I know. I'll have to ask you for some help about that later. I did year before, October before last. I did a
but I
week.
I would never be as pretentious as saying, "Yes, I lose myself. If I'm playing a hairdresser, I go to hairdresser school and I really understand how to cut a hair, and then I can go and I can be real on the movie, and I will get my scissors and it'll look real." You know? Are you kidding?
And I'll feel the part, man. I'll really feel it. It'll be me.
Yeah. Where are the scissors? Where are the fucking scissors? You know, I can't.
Yeah.
Although,
I was going to say, October before last, I worked a week on Stranger Things. And it was a night shoot all week. I don't know if you've ever seen the show Stranger Things on Netflix. But it
was, I'm very aware of the show.
Okay, so it was like 25 degrees all week, and we were shooting all night long, but it was taking place on 4th of July, so we're all in summer clothes. And, of course, I had to start, you know, I had on a dress with short sleeves, so every night I started putting a long-sleeve T-shirt underneath and some yoga pants, and I had to pull them up under my skirt and pull the sleeves up under my short sleeves. And then when I saw myself on TV, I thought, my gosh, all that thermal underwear, I look so chunky in that, but
see, I'm way too narcissistic to have done something like that. I would have been naked. I would naked and freezing, which is the title of my next movie. Very exciting.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait.
No, I'm
well, you
kidding.
Know, well, something, you know, it takes place in the 80s, as you know, and there were some kids there, maybe 17, 18, and they had got on those Tom Selleck type running shorts and tank tops and the knee socks, and the boys and the girls are going, "Did people really dress this way back then?" I said, "Yes, honey, that's when club drugs became popular. How else would a guy dress like you get laid?" But I've got somebody here wants to talk to you. Hi. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon. You're on the air with Marquis Michael DeBar. Say hello. Introduce yourself.
Is that me?
Hi. Yeah, hi.
That's
okay.
You.
Oh, hi. Hi, Jen. It's Belle. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are
Belle.
You?
Hi,
I love
no,
all
I,
your
I,
friends
I,
are calling in.
Yeah, I tried to call a few times before, and I wasn't sure if the... I saw
you
your
are.
Documentary. Thank
well, good.
You.
Enjoy it.
By the way, that's quite a story.
Hmm. It is indeed. What part of it did you relate to the most?
Probably the trying to figure out who you are. You've talked a bit about, Jen, I guess you can relate this to shifting personas with each, I don't want to say each lifetime, but now my mom died when I was little and I ended up growing up in the system, long and the short of it, and now I'm an actress. So
Good for you. I'm sorry to hear that. But it is what it is, you know.
Yeah.
I never knew, so you had a bigger loss than I did because I never knew them, really.
Your dad?
You know, I ran across
mom,
them over. Yeah, so I'm sorry that's tough. And now you're an actress, so good for you.
Hi, Jen and Mike, I did write a song thing for you, if you want me to sing it to you guys.
Yeah, hold one second. I met Belle on the set. We were working on the show called The Hot Ones with the guy Sean.
Yeah.
What's his name? Sean Evans. It's where he makes people eat hot wings hotter and hotter.
Uh-huh.
And in between.
I have no idea what that is.
We've lost him then.
It's a game show where they bring people out and they make them have to eat the hottest sauce possible on the wings, and then with the audience, we have to yell, clean that wing, and then they ask them trivia questions. And in between,
I would rather date Charles Manson than watch a show like that.
Hey, my agent booked it. Don't judge me.
Well,
I'm not judging you, darling. I'm simply telling you what I wouldn't do.
I
don't watch television, really.
I'm sure the marquee understands. A girl and a guy have to turn a buck. But anyway, in between two
shows. Not with hot
shows,
sauce, darling. Not with hot sauce. You know, I provide the hot sauce.
In between
bring
shows.
Hot sauce. Yeah.
they would ask people, some of us that are working on the show in between tapings, if we would come out and entertain the audience. I guess the comedian was getting tired, and Belle comes out. She was working on a different side of the studio from me, and she comes out and does this freestyle about what's going on. This is her gift. And after I posted last week on Instagram about who do you want me to be, Michael DeBar is going to be on the show, then she sent me a private message saying, I've got it. My friends have got it. We're all watching it now. We can't wait to hear him. So, Belle, you got a little freestyle? Go for the marquee, Michael DeBar?
All right. I was running as you talked, so I'm glad I called in when I did, because there were a lot of gems in there. But here we go. We were young and restless, chasing fire, love, and fun. Changing voices, choices, and guest lists, trying to find the one. Tell me if I'm right for you, but if you let me take you somewhere new, I'll be a no regret, a little star, a let fire off a lucky shot. Go and place your bets on any silhouette. What we are is what we've got. And now where does the time go, baby? What do these words mean? Madame Marquis, a little you and me. The things we can be, the things that I've seen, with some luck and pluck and dreams. I'll be a no regret, a little star roulette, fire off a lucky shot. Go and place your bets on any silhouette. What we are is what we've got. And yes, you heard me right, the words I say. I tell a story every day. Skip the nonsense, the dull and droll. I want to dance right to the heart and soul. Colors, questions, thoughts that shape her. Words that must be thrown to paper. So take the faith, show me passion. Don't ever say it's gone out of fashion. So from one heart grasping to another, asking if there's ever time to cover the world we're trying to discover. I heard one say, "Will we have each other?" And there you go.
Well, that's very nice. It's a very, very, very sweet. You've got a lovely voice, and it's all in tune. What do you write songs with an instrument, or what is the story there?
I just kind of sing to the melody in my head.
Well, remember, when you write a song, it was beautiful, and the words are wonderful, and you absolutely have perfect pitch. But when you do that, think in terms of a verse and a chorus, and so there's a difference.
Okay.
So you sing the narrative in the verse, and then when you hit the chorus, you know, have a title of it and repeat that title. You know, songs have choruses. Do you know what that means?
Yeah, did I not put that in there with the I'm listening with the no regrets star roulette thing?
Yeah, but at the end, halfway through, you just sang the same melody for the last half of that song. It just repeated itself. There was no climax to it. It was making love, but there was no orgasm. Do you see what I mean?
Oh. I'm 23, not quite, but I can draw the line.
You're 23 years old?
Yes, sir.
Well, good for you. This is what you should do. Find somebody that plays an instrument and write songs with them, because you've got a really good voice. And obviously a lyrical ability, but you've got to work at it's music. It's not a straight line.
No, I understand. Yeah.
It has to move.
I don't. Dan, you don't play, do you?
Michael?
I play every instrument.
Oh, baby. Yeah.
Yeah, I've written many, many hits for many people.
You saw him play guitar on the documentary.
No, not Michael. No, I was asking you if you played. Oh, Michael, you're welcome to add music to anything I write, but I'm sure you're a very good man.
You know, that's fine, but I work with a bunch of people. But I'm saying you should find somebody to play music with. But thank you so much. It sounded great.
Yeah. No,
I'm
a drummer. I'm a drummer, Belle, but my husband's a musician. I'm a chick singer. Do you know what that means?
No.
Michael, I bet he does. Michael, how do you know when there's a chick singer at the door?
I can smell them.
Well, that shoots the hell out of... She can't find the key. She doesn't know when to come in. Okay, so...
Oh, that's a good song title, sweetie.
Oh, I can tell her. That is a good song. I'm going to write that down. I'll save that for later. She can't find it.
Okay.
She
well, thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks
it's
so much,
sweet.
Belle. And I'm glad.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Right. And I'm glad
bye.
You bought the documentary.
I appreciate the criticism, Michael. Like, I genuinely did.
Oh, sure. No, it wasn't criticism. It was, a genuinely an observation.
Yeah, maybe a coach.
Make your music even more interesting.
Sure. All right. Well, you two take care. I'll be listening.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye.
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 And again, thanks for purchasing. Who do you want to be? I've got so many things to ask you about. And you, do you still play guitar a lot?
Every day.
Every day.
Every day. Yeah, I'm a musician. I write and play music all the time.
Do you have any preference over dramatic or comedic work?
No, it's all the same. If you look at it, it's a question that one has asked, you know, for many, many, many years. But hypothetically, Heath Ledger, who was a wonderful actor, the Joker was a villainous murderer, but he was amusing, wasn't he? Right. So therefore, you can't go into it and try and be funny, and you can't go in it and try and be villainous. You just understand the words, understand the situation, and whatever happens, happens. It's very difficult to be funny when your line is, I'm going to kill you now. But in a way, you can make it funny, you know?
Well,
and
yeah,
that surprises the audience. So you'd know,
yeah,
I don't think too much. I don't think. I do it. I don't think too much about it.
Well, you you definitely squeeze a lot out of Murdoch. And
yes, I'm a good squeezer.
A renowned squeezer.
Yes, it's my new band name, Michael DeBon the Squeezers. Very
a
exciting.
Squeezer with the provenance. So,
indeed.
Murdoch
was funny. I mean, Murdoch, yeah. You know, a lot of kids that dug Murdoch, and even now as grown-ups or in reruns, the extraordinary thing about doing a series in the 80s, and I did a lot of telly in the 80s and 90s, is that for a lot of people, I will always be that guy. So when they come up to me in the street and go, oh, Murdoch, you're such a bastard, and do you remember that episode where you did that? And of course I don't remember. But you can't say, oh, that was episode 7, about 26 minutes in, when I took my hat off. Yes. You know, I don't remember. You know, so,
but come on.
But you don't
want to
let
on.
Anybody down. You don't, you know, you don't want to say, oh, yeah, you know, you go, oh, yeah, that was great. You know, but they see you as that person then, even now, you know, when I'm 40, 30 years ago. And I look very different.
How does it feel when people remember that much detail about you?
Because it's on every day.
No.
When you do those TV shows, it's on somewhere every day. MacGyver is played at Melrose Place. All of Seinfeld, WKRP, all the series that I did are still playing
okay.
somewhere.
All right. You talk about, you know, the one thing with music, comedy, timing. And when you were on Seinfeld and the snooty Mater D and they shove you in that car. I mean, even from the beginning when they walk in to talk to you about the car, I mean, it just seems like everything is just bam, bam, you know, beat, beat, beat on the between you and George and Jerry.
Yeah,
that
well, it's rhythmic, you know. There's a rhythm to setting up a joke, and you know, I mean, I used to talk about it with Jason, you know, because Jerry was so deadpan, and Jason was like a true actor, comedian, you know, but a brilliant actor, and we would talk about the rhythm of it all, and Jerry has a particular rhythm, but I'm coming in there like a, you know, a snotty maitre d'. It's so obvious, you know, you're English and you won't let somebody have the best table unless they give you, slip you $100. You know, there's a million things that are going through your head that makes it real. But because if it's comedic, then you have to do it at a certain pace. You know, it's faster and bouncing off the other actor. You know, I don't know. It just comes naturally. It's like music. You know, the drummer drums, the bass player plays that bass and it fits together. If it's good, it fits. And I've been lucky. I've worked with great actors.
Mm-hmm. And they certainly say the same about you. You were on, I think it was an episode of Suits.
Of Suits, yes, yes.
And
that's where I met Meghan
Markle.
Did you
ever think?
Yes, I had wild sex with a princess. Yeah.
And if she's ever on the throne, well, I don't know. You never know with them. You know, they kind of.
I would be knighted. They would knight me. Sir Michael. Yeah. The Marquis Sir Michael. Thank you. Yet another title from Meghan. Yeah. Why not? No. But in all seriousness, she was great. I thought she was really fun. The crew loved her. Everybody loved her. She was very seductive and a terrific actress.
Oh, that's fantastic. What about working with Clint Eastwood?
Great. A miracle. I mean, I got the gig via video, and I talk like this, like a bad guy, and I want to kill that motherfucker. I want to do this. I want to do that. And Clint saw the video. I never met him, you know. And when I did meet him, it was in Nevada, in the mountains, just outside, you know, in Nevada, to play this biker guy, you know, this Aryan Brotherhood biker guy. And he didn't know I was English, you know. And I go up to him on the set and in my leather jacket, my ponytail and my gun, and I'm about to do a scene, and I say to him, go ahead, make my career. And he left his house off. And we became really good friends. It's fucking awesome. I loved him. He was the best. That night, dig this, that night he takes me into the trailer, which was, yeah, we were on vacation, so he's in a trailer, but the trailer was Schwarzenegger's gym. And Clint had gotten it off Schwarzenegger, and he sat me down and he showed me, this is the first night of shooting this movie, Pink Cadillac, and he showed me a movie on Thelonious Monk, the jazz piano player, the avant-garde, because he loves music.
Oh,
and he
yeah.
sat me down and he watched it. We watched it in silence. Now, I'm sitting next to Dirty Harry, for Christ's sake. I mean, I am in cinematic heaven, you know, and watching Thelonious Monk with Clint Eastwood in Arnold Schwarzenegger's trailer. I mean, this is epic. And I'll never forget that moment. And at the end of the movie, the Warner Brothers logo comes up, which is a shield, as you know. And then the lights went on in the trailer. But there was a Warner Brothers flunky in the back. And Clint turns around and says, take the shield off. And by that, he meant, I don't want it to look like a corporatized documentary. I want that logo off the movie.
Really?
How about that?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Great man. I mean, his politics, of course, we couldn't be further apart politically. But that's not the point. He's an icon. And to look into that face that I've looked into since I was a child, it was a blessing.
I'm gobsmacked thinking of you. This is the first day you've met him after the first day, first night, and you're in that trailer and he's watching, you're watching, he wants you to watch this
yeah.
with him about the Thelonious
yes.
Monk.
And, yes.
And that's, okay, I yes. don't even know the
and
word for that.
Reason,
that's bringing you into
well,
the fold, I think.
Yes, very smart of you, Matthew. Very smart of you, because I could feel that he was going, he really wanted to see how I would respond to it, because it's how I would respond to it is why, you know, we got along so well, because he could see that, you know, when you're watching a musician and he plays something that is so amazing and avant-garde and brilliant and unexpected, and you gasp or something, you know that that person is listening and understands the art that is happening, and I think that that's what bonded us, you know. And we talked about music for the next 2 months, and Bernadette too, you know, was on the show, and she was equally brilliant. Bernadette Peters, you know, equally brilliant
yeah.
as a singer. So the three of us would have many a chin wag in between setups, you know, about the greatness of music and what that means, the flow and the rhythm of an actor or an actress is based on rhythm, which is music, which is why when people say, well, what do you like best? I say both.
Yeah.
You know, and it's impossible to say one or the other.
I've seen her twice on Broadway with this, Annie Get Your Gun.
Yeah.
And the other was...
Great artist.
Yeah, yeah. And Gypsy.
Yeah, she's amazing. And Clint was amazing. And it's an incredible movie to make, you know. I made a lot of good friends in that movie. And my gang, my biker gang. And, you know, it was fun. It was Clint Eastwood, for God's sake.
And for God's sake, Clint. And he's in Atlanta a lot. Because whenever he's in town working on something. Because there is a friend of mine who plays trumpet, Joe Grandston. And he sings, but he's also he's a bit like Chet Baker. And Eastwood mm-hmm. is just enamored of him. And, you know, he was talking one time, maybe doing something about Chet Baker and having Joe Grandston play Chet. But he'll if he's in town.
Well, they tried it. Ethan Hawke did a Chet Baker movie. I don't know if you're aware of that. But it's and he was very good. But it's impossible to capture the charisma. That's why Chadwick Boseman was so amazing. You know, because when he played James Brown, I mean, that, you know, And I'm a DJ, you know, I play James Brown every day, virtually. And to see Chadwick do that was one of the greatest things. And it's so weird because a couple of days before he died, I watched that movie of Chadwick as James Brown. And then I was looking at my phone and it came up that he died. And I was just shattered, you know. And it's so interesting because this morning I just played Shout and Shimmy, which is a James Brown song. And I couldn't in my mind distinguish between the real James Brown and Chadwick's performance as James Brown. They are so now universally linked in my mind. I'm sure that will separate. But that's how incredible he was. That actor, unbelievable actor, incredible actor. And it makes me very happy to see great work.
Yes, it does. And I tell you, I think there was just a collective across the world when so many, thousands, millions of people who admired him and his work, him as a person, but also his work so much. And then I think we all probably had the little things dropped down on our devices or phone, iPad, whatever, when he passed. I think there was just a collective holding of breath in the world because he was so
young.
Well,
the tweet, his last tweet was the most tweeted tweet in history. Chadwick's last tweet.
Really?
Yes. So, yes, he was a beloved artist and will remain so. And, you know, when I wrote about him for some magazine, and I, you know, my whole thing was the reason that he could play great icons is because he was great. He brought greatness to these roles that were people who were icons. And as a result, you know, he will remain an icon himself.
Mm. By the way, I've just had a message from Jules Perry, no relation, but she's a rock photographer, and she said, this guy is such a good talker. I am fascinated, and she said, sometime you're going to have a Zoom hangout on one of these interviews or a virtual after party so we can talk about the shows. But she said she and her husband are getting the documentary to watch tomorrow night. And so
I hope they enjoy it. I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
You know,
the director,
Josh Weinstein, is how you pronounce it. It was his first movie. It was very, very expensive to make because, as you can see, it's a very well-made movie. It's not some black and white, stupid, you know, documentary about some bass player nobody's heard of. You know, it was a very, very cleverly made movie, and it cost a fortune. And thankfully, it is doing very, very well. And I was so honored to work with the guy. He'd never made a movie before. And I never watched a frame of it, by the way. And it took 8 years. And I never watched it.
Really?
I was never in the room with Don Johnson. I was never in the room with John Taylor or Steve Jones when they did their Gabriel, all of it, Gabriel Byrne. All of the people in the movie, I was never there at the interviews. And I never watched a frame of it until it was done.
Whoa. Speaking of frame, Josh is also a comedian, isn't he? As well as a writer?
Yeah.
He's funny.
He's a writer, producer, comedian, filmmaker. Brilliant.
By the way, speaking of frame, that's one of the things my husband thought was a very nice device, was the picture frames.
Yeah.
In that.
Well, who do you want me to be? You know, there's all these guys on the wall. You know what I mean? I mean, it was so clever. You know, it was a very clever conceit to put me in a gallery because I am a gallery.
Michael DeBarth, you have been so generous tonight with your time and your stories and sharing everything. I am just so grateful to you for spending so much time with us here.
Well, I'm happy to, Madam Jennifer, and I wish you continued success. Clearly, you're a brilliant interviewer. Your show is spectacular, and listening to all your friends and. Thank you so much, and I'm sure our paths will cross soon.
I hope so. Maybe we'll both be acting in Atlanta soon again.
Well, we're scheduled to go back any minute. You know, I'm going to be there any minute, I would imagine, you know, because it's for the next season. But, you know, God bless you. Thank you so much. I'm going to run now and take care of business. But I love you, and all you guys out there, be cool.
Mike, I love you. All of you, thank you, Michael Carter. Madame Perry says, beware.